You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. The title of Rosa Brooks' excellent and very necessary book is How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. And today, is today not the perfect day to discuss this book? The same day the U.S. government dropped the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan, the same day we learned that a U.S.-led missile strike mistakenly killed 18 coalition allies in Syria. Where was Congress, you might ask? I certainly do. Rosa Brooks has a verifiable credibility when she writes about war and peace and the rule of law. Over the years, her work has brought her to dozens of countries around the globe, from Afghanistan, Iraq, China, and Indonesia to the Balkans and sub-Saharan Africa. She's worked at the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. She's served as a senior advisor at the U.S. Department of State, as well as a consultant for Human Rights Watch. She's currently a tenured law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything is perhaps the first serious book to examine what happens when the ancient boundary between war and peace is erased. Author Phil Clay, himself a veteran, noted, quote, "For anyone troubled by our murky and perpetual wars, Rosa Brooks offers a deeply challenging response to the question, what the hell is going on here and what can we do about it?" To Brooks, raised in a family of left-wing anti-war activists, serving 2 years at the Pentagon was analogous to, in her words, conducting anthropological fieldwork in some exotic and unpredictable foreign tribe. The stories she brings back from that fieldwork are indelible, rich in their characters and setting, the work of a very gifted writer. Last week, I got to spend an afternoon at the Imperial War Museum in London looking at the World War I gas masks and reading the descriptions of trench warfare. And as horrible as it was, and it was truly horrible, war was then conducted in a specific place among combatants who could physically see and sometimes even hear each other. This is no longer true, and no longer do the old rules apply. Rosa Brooks asks two absolutely essential contemporary questions. One, quote, "In a world in which the push of a button can lead within seconds to the death of a specific man more than 8,000 miles away, is it possible to define war with any clarity?" And two, quote, "As the boundaries around war and the military grow ever more blurry, will we all pay a price?" Unquote. Perhaps now we can all contemplate the price we are already paying. Rosa's interlocutor tonight, Nicholas Goldberg, her former editor at the LA Times when she was writing a column, is the editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial pages. He's a former reporter and editor at Newsday. He's reported all over the world. He worked as the Middle East bureau chief for Newsday from 1995 to 1998. His own writing has been widely published, and we're always thrilled and delighted to welcome Nicholas back to Aloud. So please join me in welcoming Rosa Brooks and Nicholas Goldberg to the stage of the LA Public Library.
All right. Am I following you, or are you following me?
Hello. Can you hear me? Is my mic working? Good. I'm Nick. Thanks for coming tonight. I wanted to start by saying how pleased I am to be here with Rosa, who almost qualifies at this point as an old friend. We worked together for about 5 years when she wrote a column for the op-ed page, when I was the op-ed page editor of the LA Times. I think you wrote it from 2005 to 2009. And I just was remembering as I was thinking about tonight's event, I was remembering how Rosa got hired, and that is that at that time, the editorial page editor of the LA Times was Michael Kinsley, the really great a wonderful editor and writer, and Mike came in one day and he said to me, I have a new columnist that I want us to hire. And I said, okay, who is it? And he said, Rosa Brooks. And I said, well, who's that? And he said, I saw her last night on Bill O'Reilly. I think it was Bill O'Reilly. I saw her on Bill O'Reilly, and she was great. I said, well, Mike, that's fine, but you saw her for 5 minutes on a TV show. What indication is there that she can write a column or that she has anything more than 5 minutes worth to say? Because writing a column is really very difficult. It involves coming up with an idea every single week, having it be different, having it be interesting, having it be well-written. It requires a tremendous amount of stamina and an awful lot of ideas. And Mike said, and Mike's a famous editor who has hired many great people in his day, and Mike said, I just have a feeling. And I said, he was the boss, so I said, okay. And for 5 years, Rosa wrote a really smart, fabulous, interesting, beautifully written, passionately felt column. So Mike was right, and I learned something from
that. The part of the story that you didn't tell, Nick, is that I was on this terrible Fox News show, and Bill O'Reilly was going after Mike Kinsley by name on his show, and I defended him.
I had no idea.
And I got home, and it was nighttime. It was, 10 or 11 at night by the time I got back from the studio, and I checked my email, and there's this email from Michael Kinsley, who I'd never met, saying, you were wonderful. How would you like to write a column for us? It could be weekly. It could be twice a week. And I thought he is drunk.
That's
and I
what
thought,
he
I better
like
say yes
sober.
Before he sobers up and changes his mind. But I felt really bad for the rest of you having to put up with me.
I don't think I ever heard that part of the story. I had no idea there was any self-interest on his part. Anyway, so Rosa's written this this wonderful book, which is part... I'm sorry, I feel like I can't see the people over there. The book is part memoir, and it's part... politics, and it's part foreign policy analysis. It does all sorts of things, but I thought we'd start, if it's okay with you, on sort of the lighter part of it, which is the memoirish part, which is, tell us, I mean, Louise said you came from a family of left-wingers. Tell us a little bit about your own background and why it is so odd to so many people when they read the book that you ended up in the Pentagon.
So we're telling embarrassing personal stories now. Okay. It is true. I come from a left-wing background. My brother is sitting out there in the audience. He can verify this. We spent our childhoods at anti-war protests and walking picket lines. In fact, one of my earliest memories is sitting on a picnic blanket in New York Central Park in 1974, celebrating the end of the Vietnam War. Of course, my primary memory is somebody gave me a lollipop with those little cross sticks, which was so incredibly exotic, it stays in my mind even today. But so it was not a foregone conclusion that I was going to end up working at the Pentagon or marrying an Army officer. And in fact, I remember talking to my brother when I got offered a job at the Pentagon and saying, I'm a little scared to tell Mom that she might disown me or something. I think she had only been at the Pentagon to try to levitate it. But one of the stories that is actually referenced on the book jacket, after a couple of months at the Pentagon, I sort of worked up the courage to invite my mother to come and have lunch with me at the Pentagon. And so she lives in Alexandria, Virginia, easy metro ride over to the Pentagon. She comes in the metro, and I sign her in through the visitor's entrance, and she goes through all the security, and we go up the escalator. We're going through the corridors, and we walk past the chocolate shop and the florist and the CVS drugs and the bank machine and the barber shop and the Starbucks and the cafes, and she suddenly stops short just in the middle of the corridor, which is not actually a good thing to do at the Pentagon because all these people are like rushing past you. It's like at the LA freeway. And she stopped and looked around, and I said, Mom, what's the matter? And she said, you're telling me that the heart of American military power is a shopping mall? pretty much.
So how did you end up there, and what was your job?
I ended up there a little bit randomly. I had worked in human rights law and doing human rights work for years, and that had gotten me into some sort of post-conflict reconstruction work, which in turn brought me into contact with a fair number of people in the military in places like Kosovo and Sierra Leone. So I was writing about rule of law issues after military interventions. And then when Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, I did what quite a lot of people in the D.C. area were doing, is I sent a whole bunch of obsequious emails to everyone I'd ever met saying, you know, I really would love to work for this administration. I will make coffee. I will sweep the floor. You know, I could even write columns. One of the people I sent those, I would have worked anywhere in the federal government at that point. I sent off my sad little emails to people at multiple different government agencies. But one of the people I emailed was a woman named Michelle Flournoy, who I knew only slightly, but she had just been nominated to be the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And I emailed her, and she was the first person foolish enough to respond positively to my email. And she said, okay, you know, why don't you come and work for me? I'm not quite sure what you'll do. Everybody else she was hiring was an expert on, you know, nuclear weapons or an expert on Southeast Asia or something. And I wasn't, I said, I'm a columnist. I ask me anything, I'll have an opinion. And so she hired me, and we didn't quite know what I would do at first, and I ended up being her speechwriter and writing her speeches and congressional testimony initially, which I didn't really want to do because I liked having my own opinions, not having somebody else's opinions. But it turned out to be a fantastic education because it forced me to get to know people throughout the Defense Department and learn about lots and lots of different issues. So even though I didn't really enjoy the speechwriting part, it was a terrific education. And then after a while, my job just morphed into a broader role, and I ended up starting an office of my own on human rights and humanitarian policy within the Pentagon.
Okay, and we're going to talk about that. But before we get to the more serious part, just a couple more questions. What was the cultural adjustment like? What was the weirdest thing about it? What did you have to get used to? What was it like dealing with this? What was the anthropology of this place that you found yourself that you'd never been before? Yeah. And where many people, you know, work their way up for their whole lives.
Yeah, no. One of the things I actually talk about in the book, if any of you have read the book, actually, I hope you will read the book or at least buy it if you don't read it. So I'll tell you about it. Just buy it. And then you can save time. But one of the things I talk about in the book is the way in which different human societies throughout history have sought to draw lines between war and peace, warriors and civilians. And I talk about the ways in which societies would wear the pelts of wolves and bears to make them more fearsome when they went into battle. So they'd take on these attributes or strange initiation rituals and dances and music. And we tend to think of these, we think, oh, yes, all these primitive societies do these strange rituals. But, of course, we do, too. Anyone here been in the military? A handful of you. Remember basic training, right? You go, and what are the first things that happen? Your hair is shorn. Your clothes are taken away. You're given a set of mysterious little metal and cloth emblems to wear on your clothing. You engage in ritualized dance known as drill and ceremony, which has no military function whatsoever at this point in time, but serves the purpose essentially to foster a warrior identity and take away the civilian identity. And we even do, much like all of those primitive groups, we name our weapon systems after predators like the hornet and the blackhawk and the reaper, in the hopes that we'll take on the attributes of those predatory animals too. So realizing that you really in some ways had stepped into a tribe, which had multiple subtribes, of course, and the subtribes really mattered, you know, that I think many civilians think Air Force, Navy, Army, Marines, what's the difference? They're all kind of like troops, right? But obviously, if you're a Marine, you really don't think you have anything at all in common with someone in the Air Force.
How long did it take you to learn ranks and learn what the uniforms meant and learn who was in which service?
It took months, and it was like doing an immersion course in a foreign language. I I think I dreamed about work every night for a year, you know, and they weren't even interesting dreams. They were boring dreams. They were dreams in which I wrote memos and went to meetings. And I mean, I have the most literal boring dreams in the world. A shrink would just tear their hair out in frustration. But it felt like it just sort of occupied every corner of my brain, sleeping and waking, just trying to learn this new culture, really, for me, and learn its rituals and learn its language and learn the acronyms and learn what the little pieces of metal and the little colored ribbons meant and
be
able to
talk about the acronyms.
That.
I don't know if you can remember them all, but in the book, you're very funny.
I know lots of acronyms. yeah, no, knowing the difference between a DFAC and an MRAP, for instance, is very important since one of them is the dining facility and the other is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle. So you don't want to mistake the MRAPs or the MREs for the DFACs. But yeah, there was another one which I'm embarrassed to say it took me about 6 months or a year to figure out because people were always talking about the .mil PF spectrum. And whenever anybody says dot anything, of course, what do we think of? We think of websites. And so I figured that the .mil PF spectrum had something to do with the military's website. And it took me about a year to discover that, in fact, it was an acronym, which stood for, oh, gosh, now I can't remember everything. But, you know, doctrine, ordnance, you know, technology, materiel, et cetera. And so for an entire year, I thought we were talking about websites and everybody else was talking about something completely different.
So at one point in the book, you say, early on in the book, you say, I was part of a machine that sent people to kill and die. And then you say, it sobered and saddened me, but it rarely disturbed my sleep.
That's because I was busy dreaming about memos. I didn't have any.
What do you mean by that?
I didn't have any time for anything else. No, I mean, you know, that's what you're doing, right? I think that's what a large part of the federal government is doing. We're engaged in a death-dealing enterprise. And just as all of us as citizens are responsible in some deep sense for force used by police officers, all of us as citizens are responsible in some deep sense for the bombs dropped in our name. And when you work at, and I think we tend to try to deny it to ourselves. It's uncomfortable. But when you work in the heart of the beast, you can't deny it to yourself that every morning I would see the reports of U.S. troops killed in the previous 24 hours. And you'd see these casualty estimates of numbers of Taliban troops or al-Qaeda fighters presumed killed. I was so busy, in a sense, dreaming about memos. There was so much that was new that it was hard for it to sink in fully at first, even though, obviously, I knew it. If it's intellectually, you know it.
And you weren't just in the Pentagon. I mean, you were out. You did go out to the field, right? Mm-hmm. You were in. Where
yeah.
were you?
Mostly a few trips to Afghanistan, a couple of trips to Guantanamo, a few other places.
Iraq.
I'd been to Iraq previously, but not actually while I was at the Pentagon.
So you talk about a lot of things in the book. You talk about drones and extrajudicial cross-border killings and indefinite detention and Guantanamo and all sorts of things. And I want to talk about all of them if we have time. But the chief premise of the book is that the line between war and peace is blurring and that we used to be able to keep war in a box in a certain way, and now we can't. Can you explain what you mean by that and mm-hmm. what the change has been?
Yeah, I think that what's happened in the post 9/11 world, and these are trends that started before 9/11, but certainly accelerated and were I think made crystallized after 9/11. We've started to view more and more threats through the lens of war, non-state, geographically diffuse terrorist networks. We view as war cyber threats. We view as war. Increasingly, we've tended to look at everything through this war framework. And that's not just because we had some out-of-control metaphors. George W. Bush, actually, the day before the September 11th attacks, George W. Bush was in Florida, and he was that was the whole reason he had that upside down picture book. Remember, is because ironically it was part of a campaign against illiteracy. And the day before, on September 10th, he said, "We have to declare war on illiteracy," and you know nobody thought he was going to drop bombs on it, obviously. But when a couple days later he said, we're declaring war on terror, I think we all knew immediately that this wasn't just a metaphor that then got out of control and created its own. Everything was in its image. But it was also Pearl Harbor. The Pearl Harbor attack involved, hundreds and hundreds of Japanese planes to kill fewer people than were killed during the 9/11 attacks. It took 19 guys, none of whom were affiliated with any state's military. So it's not completely nuts to say, wow, this was violence and death on a scale we associate with state-sponsored war and invasion. And yet, in some ways, it seemed totally different, obviously. Increasingly, we're in a world in which lethality on the scale we associate with war can come from quarters that don't look like militaries. And also, we're facing increasingly a world in which there are threats such as cyber attacks, which could cause disruption on a scale we associate with armed conflict, even though they're not even violent in a classic sense. So it's gotten harder to figure out how to apply these labels. We have these nice categories, war, not war, military, civilian, but increasingly things...
And chief among them is that you fight against a sovereign state, and you fight against an army that wears a uniform.
Sure,
Those are gone.
Those are basically they're not gone, but they're
in the war on terror. They're gone.
Yeah, they're increasingly occurring at the same time as we also have these conflicts with much more inchoate groups and threats, and it's just gotten very, very hard to apply these concepts in a way that is. Coherent or principled, and I, the one and only illustration in the book. There, some of you may be familiar with the little line drawing Ludwig Wittgenstein uses, the duck rabbit, and it's this drawing. It's very, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's that drawing of the, is it a vase or is it two female profiles looking at each other? It's very similar. One way you look at it looks like a duck. Another way you look at it looks like a rabbit. And Wittgenstein's point, of course, is that there are things that where language will not give us a definitive answer. You can look at it forever, and it will not suddenly reveal itself as really a duck or really a rabbit. The linguistic categories just won't help you. And similarly, I think we're in that situation right now when it comes to things like war and military and who's a combatant and so on. That we can argue until we're blue in the face, and actually I've spent the better part of the last 15 years in rooms where people are arguing exactly about these things. Say, that's a combatant, no it's not. This is an armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, no it's not. And there's no answer because the categories were just not designed with the kinds of situations we face now in mind. So no matter what you do, you're going to be shoehorning something into a category that doesn't make any sense.
So if that's the framework of the book, that war is changing and the lines are being blurred, it seems to me that the big overarching question that you ask in the book is, how can we apply the rules of war and the rules of law and international human rights to this new kind of war that's out there? So can you talk a little bit about the hundreds of years we spent trying to develop the first set of rules?
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about the hundreds and hundreds of years. Sounds like it might take a while.
but you don't have to go year by year.
I mean, so, as I said, for me, one of the most fun part of the books was doing research on the anthropology of how people think about war and peace. And as I said, essentially every human society has tried to sort of police that boundary between war and peace and the Old Norse literature talks about the berserkers who give us our modern word berserk, and they were the warriors who would don the pelts of bears and wolves when they went into combat, believing that they would literally shapeshift and become as bears and wolves. And many societies had these very elaborate rituals, not only to distinguish between war and peace when you went into war, but to distinguish on the other end when you come back. The Navajo in the American Southwest, Navajo warriors literally spoke a different dialect when they went off to war, with different vocabulary and different verb forms. And when they would return from battle, Navajo warriors would draw a line in the desert sand, and they would face enemy territory and sing, and then they would step across the line, face home territory, and resume speaking the ordinary language. And many Native American groups actually had different governance structures for wartime and peacetime, would have a war chief and a peace chief. So the peace chief would usually be a hereditary chief, and in times of peace, the peace chief was in charge. And then during times of conflict, an elected or meritocratically chosen war chief would take over. So literally the locus of government authority would change depending on whether you were in a war or not in a war. So you kind of needed to know the difference. And that's really, really common, that societies have different rules for wartime and peacetime, different forms of governance. And going back thousands of years, not just hundreds of years, you know, you see societies trying to come up with codes for warfare. Here's what's acceptable in wartime. Here's what is acceptable in peacetime. And this, of course, is, you know, this is why it matters, right? I think it can seem very academic to say, oh, well, the boundaries around war and peace are blurring, and it's harder and harder to fit things into these categories. But the reason it matters, and I can get really boring on the subject. This is my law professor self. But we have completely different bodies of rules. And to put it in its bluntest form, in peacetime, if we walk out onto the street and wait for the next person to walk by, and I, you know, bonk them on the head with this nice mug and it shatters their skull and they die, the police presumably are going to come and I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to be charged with murder, I'm going to be carted off to prison, I'll be tried and probably convicted of murder. You're not supposed to go out and kill people in peacetime. On the other hand, if you're a soldier in a war, you are expected to kill the enemy. You may get a medal if you kill someone. If you don't kill other people in war, you may be prosecuted. So the behavioral expectations for wartime and peacetime are the opposite, in a sense, literally almost opposite of each other. And our modern law reflects that.
But there are rules for war. I mean, we all know about the Geneva Conventions. We all know that soldiers are expected to behave a certain way. But as you point out in the book, as the lines blur, those conventions, those rules, often don't fit the situation anymore.
Well, and you don't know which body of rules to apply. So during wartime, we tolerate much more government secrecy than we do during peacetime. We tolerate government surveillance. We detain people in wartime, not because we have gotten a warrant for their arrest and put them on trial and proven them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but just because we want to keep them off the battlefield until the conflict's over. In wartime, you can kill people, and soldiers who kill enemy combatants in wartime have what the law calls combatant immunity. You don't get prosecuted for that. And in peacetime, it's the opposite. Our focus is on individual rights, it's on due process, it's on checks and balances. So essentially, the government has lots of power. You know, if you call something a war, to say, this is war, we're at war with X, cyber is war, we're at war with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, is, among other things, to invoke a body of law that is very, very tolerant of government coercion, lethal force, and secrecy. Whereas if you label something not war, then instead you get this very different legal framework, which is much more protective of individual rights.
But to take one of your examples, during war you're allowed to detain people and hold them and incarcerate them without a jury trial and a conviction, etc. But it's all based on the assumption that the war will come to an end,
right,
and that the other side, the other government you're fighting, will surrender, and then you'll release your prisoners and they'll release theirs. But in the global war on terror, as the Bush administration called it, there is no end.
If it doesn't end, then you're suddenly in this framework where you're permitted. We tolerate this totally different set of rules during wartime because we think of wartime as an exception to the norm. We think of it as a bounded exception. So, okay, you say, oh, yeah, wartime is different. We have to give the government much greater power and much more latitude. But that's okay because it's temporary and the war is going to end. But if you're not sure what a war is, you don't know which rules to apply from the get-go, And if you choose to apply the war rules in a situation in which realistically something like the war on terror, you know, has, by definition, has no boundaries in either space or time, then you potentially find yourself applying war rules more or less forever. And just to, you know, give another concrete example of one of the ways in which it matters, take something that's been very controversial, U.S. drone strikes in places like Yemen or Pakistan or Somalia, you know, e.g. outside of so-called hot battlefields where we're targeting a particular individual. You know, if you think, okay, we're targeting so-and-so in Yemen or Pakistan, and I accept that there is an armed conflict, there's a war against Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and I accept that that war is wherever the bad guys are, any place on earth that I can find the bad guy, and I accept that this particular person is an enemy combatant or a civilian participating directly in hostilities, and I know what hostilities are and so on, well, then if I target that person with a Hellfire missile from a Predator drone, it's legally and morally identical to an American soldier on the beaches of Normandy during the D-Day invasion shooting at a German machine gunner. There is no difference morally or legally. On the other hand, if I'm not sure that there's an armed conflict going on, or that the armed conflict is in that place between these parties, or I'm not sure that that person is a combatant, then it's just murder. Then the U.S. is going around the world murdering people, and we really want to know the difference.
You quoted President Obama saying that there are profound, that the drone strikes raise profound concerns. I think that was the quote. What did he mean by that? And do you agree? I mean, are drone strikes, I mean, if we fire a drone into a country with which we are not at war, we kill a person who's not wearing a uniform, but who we think has, you know, been involved in inciting people to terror, are we, you know, he hasn't been tried. Mm-hmm. The American people are not aware, I think, of the targeting criteria. The American people are not aware of the process by which it's determined whether or not to go ahead with this. Is that a legitimate form of warfare? You talk a lot about drones in the book, and you talk about some of the advantages of drone warfare over the way we used to fight wars, and you talk about some of the disadvantages. So tell us what some of those advantages and disadvantages are and what you ultimately conclude.
So on the one hand, there's nothing different about drones, right? The drones are just airplanes that drop bombs on people that don't happen to have live pilots sitting in the cockpit. And you are no debtor if you're killed by a missile fired from a drone than you are if you are killed by a missile fired from a manned aircraft. So I don't think that there's any moral difference between killing somebody with an unmanned aerial vehicle versus killing somebody with a manned aerial vehicle. That said, I think what makes drones different, if anything, part of it is just that the availability of that technology lowers the perceived costs of using force, because when you know that you don't have to risk your own people, maybe you're just a little bit quicker to use force than you would be if you did have to risk your own people. And ironically, drones don't kill more civilians. They probably kill fewer, precisely because the technology, not having a human, means that you can send them down lower, you can have them hover for longer, you can have them monitor things for longer. Arguably, and I actually did at one point did some research looking at close air support in Afghanistan provided by manned aircraft. That killed a lot more civilians than drone strikes. It's a pretty, you know, humans are horrible at telling the difference, and humans fly really, really high and you can't see very well. But ironically, the fact that drones probably kill fewer unintended victims, if you will, makes us still, also lowers the perceived cost of using force. Because if you think, wow, we could really screw this up and there will be lots of dead civilians and it will look awful, then you hesitate. If you think to yourself, this illusion that it's clean, then maybe you're more willing to use force. But to me, the problem with drones, the deep problem, is not really drones as such. They're just a technology. You know, and all of the history of warfare is the history of efforts to kill from a safe distance. You know, the bow and arrow, snipers. We don't think that people should engage in hand-to-hand combat just for the heck of it, because, you know, they're your up close and personal. To me, the issue is that problem of it enables sort of the expansion and blurring of the boundaries of war still more. So you have a technology that enables you to target particular individuals and monitor, the technologies also include the surveillance and intelligence and reconnaissance technologies that enable us to monitor people for very long periods of time. So increasingly, war goes from being something where you are, one side is going after the other side simply because they're the enemy and wearing uniforms, to this sort of strange world in which we are often the people who are the targets of U.S. drone strikes. We've often been watching for weeks or months or even years, and we know what they eat for breakfast, and we know the names of their kids, and we know, you know, what time of day they go to play soccer with their friends.
We know all their routines.
Yeah, we know all their routines. So the sort of the boundaries between what looks like murder and what looks like war start to, again, blur very significantly.
I was interested that you said in the book that you met people at the Pentagon who felt that using drones was cowardly.
Yeah. Well, I think that the military ethos, many military people take very seriously the idea of honor and the code that says you have to give people the chance to surrender and so on. And obviously, realistically, nobody can surrender if you're a pilot flying a bomber from 30,000 feet. You can't exactly surrender to a bomber 30,000 feet up in the air. But I think it did cause some real queasiness for
there's
people.
There's no fear, there's no glory, yeah. There's no courage required, perhaps, to sit in a room in Wyoming and press buttons.
And I think that part of the way that humans come to terms with the behavior expected of warriors, which, again, we would consider morally impermissible in peacetime, is that they're exposing themselves to risk, too. They say, yes, I killed, but I was willing to accept the possibility that I would be killed. And I do think that a lot of people are just very, very queasy about feeling like I sit here and I push a button and somebody dies. It doesn't seem right.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say about drones is that you mentioned the PlayStation mentality. I thought that was interesting, too.
Yeah, and I don't think there is a PlayStation mentality. Uh-huh. I think that was one of the criticisms, and I think this is an area where people sort of mistake what's the problem here, and people think the problem is the technology as opposed to seeing the problem as something broader that has to do with how we apply these categories and what set of rules we apply to the different categories. Because one of the early criticisms of drone strikes was that it would create a sort of video game PlayStation mentality and Americans would come to see killing as just like a video game. But interestingly, one study of Air Force drone pilots found that drone pilots had higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than pilots of manned aircraft dropping bombs on people.
How do they explain that?
I think just that the dissonance between there you are, you're in Langley, Virginia, or you're at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and you get up in the morning in your suburban house, and you drive your SUV, take the kids to school, and you go to work, and you've been watching somebody, and you can see their faces. You know, the technology is really pretty amazing. You can see I've seen some of these video footage of drone strikes, and it's pretty upsetting. You see individual faces. You see people playing with their kids. You're tracking them for weeks. You're watching them go about their daily life, and then you see them obliterated in front of your eyes, and their limbs are flying off, and there's a pool of blood. And then you're going home,
and you see the aftermath. People come rushing in,
and you're sitting there in this simulated cockpit. And then you go home, and you pick up your kids, and you take them to soccer. And the dissonance between these experiences, I think people quite rightly find it incredibly troubling and distressing.
So let me change the subject slightly. You tell a story in the book about going to Uganda, and in Uganda you met with a bunch of parents of kids who had been kidnapped, and they said something to you about the United States that really I found interesting and moving. Do you remember what it was?
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't remember what it was.
Okay, I'll
this
tell
is
you.
My deepest fear is I'll that I'm being you. Asked a question about the book, and said on page 300 you said this incredibly powerful thing, and
well,
I think, oh my God.
I'll tell you what you said.
Please, thank you.
Because I found it very moving, because I've had this same experience. When I was a foreign correspondent, I heard this all the time from people in war situations, in terrible poverty, and all kinds of need. You went and you talked to a bunch of families that were parents of children who had been kidnapped by the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. Their lives were destroyed. Some of them were missing limbs. All kinds of terrible things had gone on. And they said to you, "We are so happy to talk to you because we know you were there for Human Rights Watch, I think. We're so happy to talk to you because we know that you're going to go back and you're going to talk to President Clinton and you're going to explain to President Clinton what's going on here." And certainly the moment President Clinton understands what's happening in our lives, of course he will come to our aid, because who wouldn't? Look at how horrible things are here compared to your country. Yeah. And needless to say, you knew, even as they were saying it to you, that wasn't the case. And I use that as a transition to talk a little bit about what the responsibility of our government and other governments are to people in countries where conditions are terrible, or where wars are going on, or where they're living, where they're facing, crimes against humanity or war crimes, mm-hmm. or other things like that. What can the world do? What should the world do? That's a big question.
That is a big question.
But you have 3 minutes because I got more questions.
It's the international policy version of what's your responsibility towards the homeless guy sitting outside the library and the next homeless guy a block away from that. That all over the world there are people suffering terribly, and not all of those people or situations can be helped, but some of them probably could, just as if you wanted to, you could probably transform the life of that homeless guy. I don't think that there is one clear legal or moral answer to that question of what's our responsibility to help people in Syria, or to have helped people in Uganda or Rwanda or the Balkans or wherever it may be. I think that it's, you help where you can.
You talk in the book about how after Rwanda and after failures to act during the Balkans wars, the world kind of came together and the world tried to come up with some solutions. And Kofi Annan and others, did have an idea for what to do, and they tried to put it into practice, and it hasn't completely worked. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, yes, absolutely. So I think that's absolutely right. Part of the dilemma for us as individuals too, right, is who do you want to help? Well, you want to help the people who ask you. The person may have asked you, maybe they asked you just because you happen to be the guy walking down the street at that moment, but once they've asked you, that's your person who asked you, and you feel a sense of responsibility that maybe you wouldn't feel if it was somebody a block away asking somebody else. And I think that the fact that in Rwanda and in the Balkans, people really were asking us to do something, and we didn't in Rwanda, and in the Balkans, we didn't for too long, and many, many people died, I think filled many, both ordinary people and policymakers, with a real sense of shame and guilt, that we were asked to help, we had the power to help, we didn't help. And people, innocent people, were slaughtered because we didn't help. And the international community, such as it is, really struggled to come to grips with that. And in the 1990s, sort of developed doctrines of humanitarian intervention, essentially trying to come up with sort of legal theories that would say, are there circumstances in which, even if the UN Security Council won't authorize the use of force, in which it is nonetheless legitimate to intervene? And the NATO intervention in Kosovo was not authorized by the Security Council. The US and other NATO states chose to intervene absent that, because there would have been a veto in the Security Council from the Russians and the Chinese. And history judged that fairly kindly. That then later sort of morphed into a legal doctrine that's referred to as the responsibility to protect doctrine, which is actually really interesting, because although it was created for humanitarian reasons, it sort of ended up in some ways legitimizing counterterrorism-based interventions. And the responsibility to protect doctrine basically says sovereignty is a privilege, not a right. And sovereignty is not absolute. And a state doesn't just get to say, you can't intervene because we're a sovereign state. If a state fails, is unwilling or unable to protect its own population, then essentially it waives its right to be considered fully sovereign.
and the responsibility shifts to other states to intervene to protect a threatened population, you know, with really awful stuff, genocide, that kind of thing, not minor things. But the responsibility then shifts to other states to intervene, anyone who can. And following that logic, if sovereignty is just a legal fiction and you waive your sovereignty if you can't protect your population, why would you need Security Council authorization? Security Council's made up of states, which themselves become illegitimate if they won't protect human beings. I mean, the doctrine basically says humans are more important than this artificial construct we call the state. You can see, obviously, right away that the problem, once you've articulated a doctrine of intervention that says, and we don't need the Security Council, well, a humanitarian emergency is often in the eye of the beholder in terms of the how terrible is it, how vital is intervention. And so that legal doctrine, which was invoked by the United States during the Libya intervention in 2011, as well as Cote d'Ivoire, less well known, was then ends up kind of legitimizing the same legal theories that enable drone strikes, because in a sense the drone strike argument is it's a variant of the Bush administration's preemptive self-defense. It sort of says, hey, if a state cannot prevent harm from being exported, you know, if it can't prevent terrorists from operating inside of its borders, then any other state that has the ability has the right to intervene. And so don't get on our case if we use drone strikes inside of Somalia or inside of Pakistan. You know, if you can't control those terrorists or the export of harm, we get to go in with or without Security Council unilaterally. So we've ended up with doctrines that ironically came from really very different communities. The responsibility to protect really came out of the humanitarian and human rights community. The sort of counterterrorism theories come from the national security community, but they end up sort of reinforcing each other and putting us back in a world where the bad news is there's no referee and states feel entitled to use military force with or without the authorization of the Security Council.
And in Libya, didn't we misuse that? We said we were going in under the responsibility to protect. We said this did not have to do with regime change. It had to do with protecting certain groups of people. But it became clear, and you know, once we had gone in, that we had a totally different motive.
Well,
and didn't that take away credibility?
That's what the Russians certainly thought, right? Mm-hmm. The Russians thought when Gaddafi was killed, the Russians sort of said, we knew it. You said you were going in for humanitarian reasons to protect civilians, but all along you just wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. I was in the government at that time, and I can say that wasn't the motive. But like many, many situations, there was some mission creep. I think that the planners of that intervention did not really think through, and this seems to be the American disease, right? You don't really think through what's going to happen after the first set of missiles is dropped, that there was a civilian protection motivation, not a regime change motivation. But then you drop enough bombs and you realize it's not working. There's no way we're going to be able to do this unless you get rid of the Gaddafi regime, and then the motive shifts.
So the current situation we have, which raises all these questions, is Syria. Can you give us a highly oversimplified two-minute answer to the question of, you know, do we have a responsibility? 500,000 people have been killed in Syria. You know, it's not letting up. Efforts to solve this diplomatically have failed. Does the United States have a responsibility to step up its military action and go in and find a way to help the people who are suffering and dying there and being displaced there? Or does it make more sense to say we screwed it up in Iraq, we screwed it up in Afghanistan, let's stay home and let them work it out themselves?
I think we have a responsibility to try to help if we can, but I don't think there's anything inevitable about help needing to take the form of military action. And I think that with any intervention, I mean, it's like the Hippocratic Oath for physicians where, you know, first do no harm. It is pretty clear from our track record that we do have a tendency to do harm while meaning well, and that's something I think we need to take really, really seriously. particularly in a setting like Syria, which is unbelievably complicated at this point, much more so than it was 5 years ago. The desire to help if you don't know what you're doing can make things worse. Help could take the form of greatly increasing the numbers of refugees we let in. Help could take the form of working a good deal harder with Russia, with Iran, with other states that are involved to try to come to a diplomatic resolution. Help could take the form of humanitarian assistance. I don't preclude the possibility that there are situations. I actually think the Kosovo intervention was one. The Rwanda non-intervention was one where an intervention would have probably done more good than harm. So I don't assume that military intervention is never either legitimate or even sometimes morally and legally required. I think Rwanda was a pretty good case for saying, boy, failure to intervene was unconscionable. But I think in Syria right now, it is such a spectacular mess, and I think our collective understanding of what is going on and who is doing what is so poor, frankly, that my own view right this minute is that we are likely to do more harm than good if we intervene.
Wouldn't be the first time.
As we are doing, indeed.
Okay, we need to open this up for questions. I have one last question to ask you. Actually, I have 1,000 more questions, but I'm going to skip to the end. I'm skipping to the end.
Is there another quiz about what's in the book?
No. No, my last question is, do you think that during your time in the Pentagon, you were able to have any substantial effect on it? And second part of the question, how did it change you?
Gosh. Substantial effect, no, not really. I think maybe the best you can ever hope for in these government positions is that on the margins you make a little bit of difference, which is better than nothing. And I did feel that there were small ways in which being a voice for certain policies and against others made a difference. But did it, change the course of the chip of state? No, regrettably, it did not. Did it change me? I came out of it with a deep sense of both how amazing and how frightening it is that we have a military that does everything, and the title of the book is How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, and they're really sort of two strands, two themes in the book, one of which is one we've talked about more tonight, which is the ways in which if you can't tell what's war and you can't tell when you should apply war rules, you end up applying war rules to everything, and you lose a lot when it comes to accountability of government and individual rights and so forth. The other theme of the book, though, is more of an institutional theme. When everything looks like a war, everything looks like a job for the military. And I think one of the lessons of the 9/11 attacks to a lot of senior military people was, wow, nobody was thinking about Afghanistan on September 10th, 2001, and a threat that killed more Americans than the attack on Pearl Harbor came out of nowhere and involved something nobody was, not nobody, a few people were, but most people weren't thinking about. And the lesson for many military planners was the next attack, the next really horrible thing will also come out of nowhere, could come from anywhere on earth, and it could take any form. But the problem is, of course, if you think that the next threat could come from anywhere and take any form, then you think you have to be everywhere and you have to do everything. And the U.S. military really is now. We have military personnel stationed in almost every country on earth, doing almost every job on earth, from NSA wiretapping to cattle vaccinations. You name it, somebody in the military is doing it. And I think that my time in the Pentagon, on the one hand, this is terrifying. On the other hand, it's kind of amazing, right? I mean, pick an issue, pick a topic, a research topic, a project. Somebody in the military is doing it. And it's an organization, every year Gallup does this poll on trust in public institutions, and it turns out the military is pretty much the last institution standing in this country. You know, Americans hate Congress. They don't really like the presidency. They don't much like the courts.
Don't like the media.
They don't like the media. They don't like academics. But they love the military, and they trust the military. And it's this institution that, for all its flaws, and it has many flaws, and for all the flaws in the ways that we use it, has this unbelievable ability to marshal human talent. You know, we could get more people, more places faster than anybody on earth, you know, whatever, and we often use them in stupid ways and sometimes in terrible ways, but it's pretty amazing that we have this institution that can do that. So I came out of it with a very profound sense of the military, both as an institution that has sort of incredible promise as the last institution standing that can mobilize a lot of human talent and idealism, and yet at the same time with a really renewed sense of, boy, and I think we're seeing it even more powerfully since the election, you know, some pretty bad things happen when you decide that the only institution you're going to bother to fund or use is the military.
Okay, I ran over my time, so let's take some questions. Oh my God, lots of hands. Okay.
You went to Guantanamo. I wonder how in the world we can justify holding people forever.
Yeah. I don't think we can, to be honest. I don't think the problem with Guantanamo is Guantanamo. The problem with Guantanamo is that we have that three presidential administrations in a row have developed legal theories and advanced legal theories that justify holding people essentially forever, preventive detention. I think it's unconscionable, and I think again, you know, it we justify it based on the assertion that we're in an armed conflict, and everybody knows that the laws of war permit you to detain enemy combatants for the duration of the conflict, and that is of course true. And is not unconscionable when we can presume that the wars, even though we may not know the precise end, there will be an end. But we now are in a situation where we all know that there is no possible end state in an armed conflict against Al-Qaeda and its endlessly proliferating and morphing associated forces. So I think it's completely unconscionable.
I just want to go back briefly to your discussion of cyber warfare. I'm wondering how you would apply your framework to not just Russian hacking of our election last year, but also their hacking of other European elections, and what one could argue is an attack on the existence of Western democracy itself. Easy question. Thanks.
Yeah, cyber is kind of the Wild West when it comes to rules, because it absolutely stymies our categories. The amount of mischief it is possible to do already, and maybe even more so sort of around the corner with cyber, is pretty unbelievable. Clausewitz said, you know, war is politics by other means, but increasingly technologies like cyber enable us to achieve the political ends of war without using physical force necessarily, but disruption on a scale that we associate with armed conflict. And we are, at the moment, there really are no rules. To the extent that there are any rules, we've sort of been trying to shoehorn it into that armed conflict category. But I don't think we have a legal framework for thinking about it that makes any sense. And I don't even think we have a political framework for thinking about it that makes any sense. And I think that's, of course, part of the reason that the Russians are, you know, they're doing exactly what a state, you know, a smart state does, which is they're exploiting that ambiguity, you know, that in a world where it is way too costly to have open conflict between two nuclear powers, it's actually really smart to do everything short of that threshold to cause confusion to your enemies. And they're doing a great job of it, right, in both Europe and in the United States, and they are kind of running rings around us right now.
Quick interruption. What are a couple of the other kinds of ways that warfare is going to change in the future? So cyber warfare is going to become more common. Are there other things we can expect to see?
Yeah, I think I'm two. I guess I'd just highlight two things. which are related, one of which would be the sort of around-the-corner biowarfare technologies, that just as we're already seeing sort of customized medicine because of advances in genetics, where you can say, okay, your cancer will respond to this treatment, but your cousin's cancer is going to be a different treatment. Those same technologies create the possibility of bioengineered viruses and other malign things that are targeted towards specific genetic codes. It's not too far around the corner to imagine bioengineered viruses that would target specific individuals and maybe kill them or maybe just disable them, make them unstable or erratic or paralyzed or any number of things. And the second thing I would mention, which is very much related to that, it's also related to cyber, it's also related to drone technologies, and a trend that we're already seeing with cyber and drone technologies, is what you could call the individualization of warfare. And I mentioned this earlier, that we think of warfare as about mass on mass, large armies, and faceless enemy, where you're not going after somebody because, you know, it's Bob Smith, you're going after them because he's a German or whatever. But increasingly, the technologies of warfare are enabling this highly personal form of warfare, where whether it's through a drone strike or whether it's through cyber mischief and I hack John Podesta's email account, or around the corner bioengineered weapons where I say, aha, I know Nick's genetic code and I can have a virus that will make you disabled but won't harm the people around you. And the possibilities of coercion, often invisible forms of coercion and control, very obviously overused word, very Orwellian, but I think that we're already there, and that's going to accelerate dramatically.
Sounds great.
It's going to be beautiful.
Yeah. With your vast array of knowledge and analysis, how do you manage that information individually? The detail that you discussed this evening just amazed me. How do you manage to get your arms around
that? As you
can
see, I forget what I said in the book. I don't.
What about the detail I missed?
Yeah, no. I rely on my friends to say, yeah, you know, you said something really interesting on page 3. I think, oh, no kidding. How about that? I find it fascinating. I mean, before I went to law school, I was an anthropology student. So for me, part of this is, I was saying to Nick earlier, I'm just nosy. I love learning all this stuff. It's fascinating. It's a lot of fun. I can't always make it fit together neatly, although I've tried, but it's endlessly fascinating. I guess I'll leave that for the rest of you to decide.
Hi, this is kind of based on one of the quotes that he said about, you know, you not disturbing your sleep. As a civilian, I don't feel, you've used the word we so many times. We meaning, I don't know if it's humanity, or we meaning the United States. As somebody who feels so far removed from all of these actions, what do you feel the duty of a civilian is as far as all these wartime actions and how it should affect us personally? And did that change for you when you got closer from a civilian as a writer into the Pentagon? Thanks.
Yeah, inevitably. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's most of us Americans, certainly, it's easy to sustain the illusion that this stuff has nothing really to do with us. It's somebody else somewhere else making decisions and doing things far away. I think that illusion is less easy to sustain. I mean, it's not true. It's an illusion, right? I mean, it's being done with our money. It's being done in our name. It's being done by people we vote for or fail to not vote for. But it's an illusion that certainly becomes harder to sustain when you're sitting in meetings with people who are saying things like, should we do this or should we not do this? And the consequences of this is, you know, will be dead people. And I think it, you know, on some level, it doesn't do to be squeamish about that, because that is our world, and all of us are part of that world, whether we want it or not. You know, that better to say, be upfront and say, yes, these are the consequences of our action and our inaction. You know, that you make one decision and this group of people dies, you make another decision and maybe a different group of people ends up dead. That there's no clean hands way to go through life. And that's obviously, you know, again, I mean, that's true on the small scale. We walk outside and we walk past people who are suffering and we hear that siren and somewhere someone is hungry or hurt, and our choices individually to care or not care, to do something or not do something, all have actions. So it's, you know, it's always hard. It's always unpleasant to be confronted with that, and it's and I don't mean to sound cavalier when I say I didn't lose sleep over it. I don't mean that it didn't. It's not something that I spent a lot of time thinking about. Actually, that didn't lose sleep over it was really more to contrast it with something that I did lose sleep over. One of the things I talk about in the book was a nightmare I had after the first time I was involved in discussions of a drone strike, and I dreamed about someone I loved being murdered, and just woke up sweating, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, every day I see these memos about deaths, and yet I haven't had these bad dreams, and yet something about this one strike left me waking up in a cold sweat. You know, and I think it was precisely this going from seeing a picture of an individual who was alive and then being told, got him, and thinking that young guy is now dead. I didn't know him, but is you know, that for all of us, and this is just always the case, it's just what it is to be human, that we respond to stories. We don't, you know, this is Stalin's, you know, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic, that when it's the Taliban or 17 Taliban militants, it doesn't somehow hit you quite as much as when you know the name and you've seen the face and you think, he's alive, now he's dead. I think it just hits you in a very different way.
Robert Gates famously deplored the fact when he was in the Defense Department that he had more members of military bands than the State Department had diplomats. Outside of Gates and people like that and the four-star generals, the people you dealt with, the field grade officers, let's say, were they bothered or concerned by that, or did they just sort of, it all kind of worked out, they can vaccinate cows or do whatever?
No, I think they were very bothered by it. I think that there is a pretty widespread awareness within the military, really at every level, that, gee, we're doing things that we weren't trained for and aren't doing all that well. Where are the civilians? We need the civilians. They're not here, so I guess we have to do this, but we don't feel great about it. So I think that's a very widespread feeling. I don't think it's going to change. It was Jim Mattis, formerly four-star Marine Corps general, now the Secretary of Defense, who said a few years ago when he was testifying before Congress, you know, he said, look, if you keep cutting the budgets of the civilian foreign policy, or, you know, State Department, USAID, you keep cutting civilian budgets, I'm going to need to buy more ammunition. And, you know, obviously his point was, you don't want to invest in development and diplomacy, you're going to have more conflict. I think Trump thought he was making a suggestion. Obviously, you cut the ammunition, buy more ammunition. So that seems to be what we're doing, right? But I don't think that was just reserved for the most senior level. I think it's a pretty widespread awareness. Not that vaccinating cows is not fun.
Or worthwhile.
Hi. Question is about war with technology. They have a lot of scientists, movies that are out right now about robots and how, like, Terminator and iRobot. Do you think that since now technology is about that, the military is going to be used in robots as a sign of, part of the military? Like, besides the drone, I'm talking about, like, flesh, like fleshly, like live robots to infiltrate our enemies?
Yeah, it's already happening. You know, I think that the ubiquity of semi-autonomous robot technologies, both in the form of drones and the form of other types of robots, is much more ubiquitous than people realize. You know, and again, as with drones, I mean, to some extent, this is sort of, you know, the exact same reasons people were happy when they invented the bow and arrow, and you don't have to stand right in front of somebody and have them, you know, stab you with his sword. You feel a lot better if you can stand on the hillside and shoot at them with your bow and arrow. It's a lot safer, you know, that this is, it's an evolution of the same impulse and the same technologies. You know, if you can send your little robot in instead of having to send in a guy who could get killed, of course you want to do that. I'm less worried about this than many of my friends. I think, you know, I don't actually think the robots are going to develop their own evil agendas and, you know. And I have these debates with many of my friends in the human rights community who say, you know, oh, it's just so terrible, these killer robots, you know, if you have decisions about life and death and distinguishing between civilians and combatants, you need to have a human make those decisions. How could you entrust this decision to a computer? You know, my own take on that is that humans are horrible at making those decisions. We are awful. You know, we panic, we don't have eyes in the back of our heads, you know, we get all screwed up when there's adrenaline coursing through our system. You know, our track record of you know, killing the right people, if you will, is rotten. Robots are way better at it. They don't panic. They can have their little camera eyes all over their heads if they want, you know. I actually think that it's not that I'm pro-robot, but I don't think that much of humans.
I think we have time for just one more question. I'm sorry.
Great. Fascinating. Thank you. Can you describe the difference between authorization to use force and declaration of war? And can you also list what entities or countries we are currently at a declaration of war with, as opposed to authorization to use force?
I can answer your first question, but not your second, because your second has no answer. The first question is there is no difference. An authorization to use force is a declaration of war for constitutional purposes. I mean, the Constitution doesn't say anything about Congress, you must use these magic words, and you must, it's like that children's game, and you throw the ball up, I declare war, you know. You don't have to say that, those magic words, saying, Mr. President, we authorize you to use force against entity X. That's a declaration of war for legal purposes. There's no distinction. Who are we at war with? Is one of the great unknowns of our time. The 2001 authorization to use military force, which was passed by Congress just a few days after the September 11 attacks, is actually, in its language, fairly narrow and was a replacement. The Bush administration initially submitted to Congress this unbelievably open-ended language, which was kind of like, we authorize the president to use force anywhere, anytime, for any reason, the end, love Congress. And Congress said, no. And the actual 2001 authorization to use military force authorize the president to use military force against the persons, states, organizations responsible for the 9/11 attacks for the purpose of preventing such attacks against the United States in the future, which is actually pretty narrow on its face. You know, it's not anybody anywhere. It's people responsible for 9/11 for a very specific purpose of attacks against the United States, but three successive administrations have just tortured that sucker out of all recognition. So it turns out that anytime you want to bomb anybody, you say, aha, well, the 2001 authorization to use military force clearly was an authorization to use force against al-Qaeda. Well, we've got all these groups that are sort of kind of like al-Qaeda. And even if they're actually fighting al-Qaeda, they were once like al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. So it turns out it's been used to authorize military force in more than half a dozen countries against at least a dozen different organizations. I think it's fairly appalling that Congress has let three presidents get away with that, but unfortunately I don't think it's going to change.
I'm sorry, we don't have time for more questions. I know there are more questions out there, but you are entitled to come up, buy a book, ask Rosa to sign it, and then you can ask her the question there. So thank you very much for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.